Howl for Carl Solomon. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the...
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, our guest is Liz Prado, author of the new essay collection, Kids in America, A Gen X Reckoning. Liz's previous books include Volcanoes, Palm Trees, and Privilege, Essays on Hawaii, which was a New York Times top summer read and a finalist for the Oregon Book Award, and the story collection, Babies on Fire. She also was editor for the story anthology, The Night and the Rain and the River, from Forest Avenue Press. Liz's work has appeared in dozens of magazines and journals and was included as notable selections in Best American Sports Writing and Best American Essays 2018. Lydia Yuknovich writes of the new book, a dazzling exploration into how cultures and identities crisscross each other. Liz Prado's Kids in America traces how Gen X emerged from the fire and fury of a nation falling to pieces. Phenomenal. Please join us for our conversation with Liz Prado, which is already in progress. Liz, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, Liz, you published a story collection, Babies on Fire, in 2015. And in interviews around that time, you mentioned you had completed a memoir, but your next two books were essay collections organized around a common theme. First, you published Volcanoes, Palm Trees, and Privilege. The common theme there is Hawaii. And the new book, Kids in America, that theme is Generation X. What's the appeal of that format for you, this collection of connected essays?
I love the short form. I love writing short stories. I love writing essays. And I think it just gives me so much leeway. It gives me leeway to explore different topics, to use different narrative stances, to use different structures. So that's a huge part of it. The biggest thing is I think I have a short attention span too. So, I mean, it's really hard for me to continue a thread throughout, 300 pages, which is what you need to do for a full-length memoir or a novel. And I really, really struggle with that. So I really prefer to write in the short form. And for me, it feels very dynamic. I like having them linked because I think that is helpful for me in terms of organizing my thoughts. And it's also helpful for the reader because readers, they like to have a common theme. Oftentimes it can be very disjointed sometimes to read, here's an essay that has nothing to do with this other essay or a story in this story that don't have any connection in any way.
And of course, there's that coherence that you find in a novel or a nonfiction book because they're all connected, like a novel in stories I've heard of. They're basically short stories, but they have recurring characters and situations.
Exactly. And I think the next book I'm working on, it'll be a marketing decision whether I call it a linked short story collection or a novel in stories.
I've actually heard that from other writers before, whether they want to do that. Now, the title of that memoir that was not published yet is called Lonesome for Her Heroes. And it's from the Allen Ginsberg poem, Howl. It's part of a litany, which he starts off, the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness. And then the quote, several lines down, who journeyed to Denver, who died in Denver, who came back to Denver and waited in vain, who watched over Denver and brooded and loaned in Denver, and finally went away to find out the time, and now Denver is lonesome for her heroes. Your hometown, by the way, is Denver.
Right.
What hit you about those lines in Ginsberg's poems?
Oh my God, it gave me chills that you actually found all this. That's fabulous. I grew up in Denver in a very idyllic time, or at least it seemed like that, where it seemed like a very safe place. My parents were married. Nobody's mental illness had really struck. Nobody's physical illnesses had really taken them away yet. And then when I became a young adult, all that started to shift pretty radically, certainly within my own family. My mom died when I was 26 years old, and my dad and my brother's mental and physical illnesses really started accelerating the decade after that. And when I would go back to Denver to visit them, it was no longer a joyful place, and it wasn't a safe place, and it wasn't an innocent place anymore. And that's what really struck me about those lines, is that I think someone had even said to me when my dad died, someone on Facebook said, it's so hard when we lose our heroes. And my dad wasn't my hero, but I really understood that idea of this thing that we had looked up to, or, you know, kept in this certain kind of light. And that's what Denver, how it changed for me. It became a depressing place. It became a difficult place. It became really a place that was more about what I lost, because what nostalgia right there became so dangerous, because what I used to have and what was left, there was such a vast chasm between those two things.
Now, talking of heroes, again, in an interview you did when the memoir, when you were writing that and Babies on Fire came out, you said, quote, most of us are trying to figure out how to be the hero of our own lives. I love that quote and wonder what it means for you, you being the hero rather than losing your heroes.
Well, ultimately, we're with ourselves the entire time. And, you know, we're living in an era, the last, 10 to 20 years, oh gosh, longer than that. Because, you know, when you think of how long The Sopranos and The Wire, how long it's been since they came out, we're anti-heroes. Were the big thing. And heroes don't have to be perfect anymore. Heroes are actually pretty broken in a lot of our narratives, but there's always something about them, some loyalty to something outside of themselves that we still get to hold them up as worthwhile and heroes. So, you know, I think for us as human beings, that's super realistic. We are going to mess up. We're going to fail, we're going to have anger, we're going to have all these other things, but still, we ourselves are the only thing we really always have. We live inside ourselves. We need to lift ourselves up. We need to respect ourselves like we would respect heroes.
And there you mentioned loss. We've been talking a little bit about that. I think there's a common theme of loss and recovery throughout most of your work. You edited a fiction anthology, came out in 2014. From Portland's Forest Avenue Press, The Night and the Rain and the River. And these are all stories from Oregon writers. And from what I read, it was a blind submission process, and you selected 22 stories from the submissions. You said that only at that point, after selecting those stories, that's when you started seeing a common thread. This is a quote from you. This was about a group of people who have a sense of longing inside of them, a sense of loss, whether it's about something tangible or someone tangible that they lost, or even a sense of losing their own identity. The stories were about those people trying to connect back with themselves and back with the world again. Given your own personal story and those of your friends and family, you definitely have an affinity for those kinds of stories.
Affinity is an interesting word, yes.
An attraction.
I don't know, ball and chain, whatever we want to call it.
Right. Kind of a destiny to write those on your own, too.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, it brings us to the new book, Kids in America, where you apply this theme of loss and recovery, survival, at least, if not redemption, to your peer group, Generation X. We should give a little background on Generation X first. It's the generation born in the U.S., and I had to look this up, from roughly 1965 to 1980, sandwiched between the baby boomers like me and the millennials. And as you mentioned in the book, there were over 65 million of you as of 2019. Did you come up with that Gen X theme first, or did you see that as a common thread running through the essays that you were writing?
I saw it as a common thread running through the essays I was writing, and I've been obsessed with the concept of Gen X for a very long time. Like before I even knew the term Gen X. When I graduated from college in 1989, I graduated into the recession and was just flailing completely and was getting ready probably to move back home to live with my mom, and it just, you know, like working minimum wage jobs. And during that period of time, Willamette Week published an article called The Gilligan Syndrome, which was talking about how this new generation kind of refuses to grow up. and it really, I have to go back and reread the whole article, but it really resonated with me. And then, you know, not long afterwards, I read Douglas Copeland's Generation X, and I realized, yeah, you know, we're part of this very different generation where we're breaking away from the traditional expectations for what people do. And we're setting our own rules. And it kind of looked like we were flailing, like, and we kind of were, but we were also okay with it. So anyway, I became obsessed with this whole idea of Gen X being a very specific kind of generation a long time ago. So I always had that back here in the back of my mind. And then when I started putting together these essays and looking at them and saying, what do they have in common? What do they have in common? I was like, well, would you look at that? We're all Gen X. Crazy. Okay, let's go with that.
Now, I have an advanced copy, a reading copy of the book. And the subtitle there was Kids in America, Essays on Gen X, where the final version is Kids in America, A Gen X Reckoning. Mm-hmm. The word reckoning has at least two meanings. It could be a summing up, kind of an analysis, but it could also mean a settling of accounts, like there's going to be a reckoning, a kind of a mm-hmm. biblical term. Mm-hmm. Why did you go with that Gen X reckoning rather than the more generic essays on Gen X?
Well, I was always wanting to have something that was a little bit more descriptive about what the essays were. I mean, because just writing essays on Gen X, I could have just been writing about Fisher-Price toys and just, you know, cute little nostalgia stuff. And I really wanted to get across that this was about something a little bit more serious than that. But even in the process of writing these essays, I find myself having to reckon with things that were very difficult, having to have an accounting, finding out a way to settle with some things that were very unsettling. Definitely rape culture and the way we looked the other way was a part of that. Racial inequality and the way we turned a blind eye on that was a huge part of it. And yeah, so that was the main reason I wanted to use that word to say, okay, like you said, you know, like, okay, here's a summary or a summing up of who we are, but here's also the things that we have to account for now. Now that we're, you know, we're at this age group where we're looking back and we're also living in a culture right now which is much more aware of so many issues like that, that we have this opportunity, if we choose to take it, to look back and examine our own behavior, own our own behavior, and then decide what we're going to do with that going forward.
Now, with 65 million Gen Xers in the country, there's bound to be as much diversity as there is common ground.
Right.
And I can just give you two examples. You were born in 1967. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who you write about in the book, was born in 1965, born 2 years and worlds apart. Mm-hmm. How'd you go about deciding on what Gen X has in common? Well, popular culture, for example, and dealing with some of the issues you mentioned, racism, rape, well, there's also terrorism, there's death mm-hmm. in the book.
Yeah.
Both personal and as a group.
I think there were a couple of things. And one of them was this idea that I did focus on in the very first essay, Gen X Prep, which is that we were the last generation that was raised without the fear of being gunned down in schools. We were the last generation raised without there being an awareness of mental illness and neurocognitive disorders in children, and therefore there wasn't treatment for it. And we were the last generation, I hope, where we weren't even talking about rape culture and gender equality and things like that very openly.
I want to get to that a little later. Yeah. Some of the essays deal directly with that. Okay. But there's another technique you use in many of the essays and in your previous work, and that's writing about yourself or your friends in the context of a movie or TV show. Mm-hmm. In the Hawaii book, you did that with a movie I love, The Descendants.
Such a good read.
Yes, with George Clooney, which also was filmed and took place in Hawaii. Yeah. And in the new book, you do something similar with movies Thunderheart, mm-hmm. Rocky, Meatballs, and TV shows like Magnum PI and Beverly Hills 90210. What does this approach do for you as a writer, and what do you hope it will do for the reader? Kind of that common ground?
Well, I'll be perfectly honest. Some of it is I have these embarrassing obsessions with certain things like 90210, and that just gave me an opportunity to write about it.
Yes, there's a long essay in the book on that.
Yeah. However, I do think that it provides this common ground. I feel like, you know, anytime we're seeing this thing in pop culture, then it gives us an opportunity to look at it in this much more accessible way, as opposed to being scolded or in a scholarly way or through the lens of trauma, those things right there. And so we get to have an understanding of that. I mean, that's one of the reasons people make TV shows and make movies, because it's a medium that can reach so many people in this very accessible way. So that's one of the reasons I do that. And one of the reasons I do that too is because I'm always looking for a way to make whatever topic I'm exploring more than about just one person or one thing. And I'm looking at a way to have it be very intimate, but very universal at the same time. And tying it back to pop culture like that often helps.
We can give an example of actually the very first essay in the book, The Indian Way. You use the movie I mentioned, Thunderheart. Mm-hmm. It came out in 1992, and it is about the Wounded Knee protest. I think that took place in the early 70s, 1973. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, that was the very tragic Wounded Knee massacre occurred there in 1890. The personal in the essay comes from your childhood friend, Mina Stays. She's a Native American you went to mm-hmm. school with. She experienced racism at school in Denver, in the Army, and then working at a telecom company, apparently in mm-hmm. Denver. And she actually moved back with her family to the Pine Ridge Reservation, which is mm-hmm. where Wounded Knee is located. It just seems a perfect example of that popular culture, the movie and the personal. They both fit together in context. They both work together so well.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's sometimes that's luck that I have these different parts of my brain, like, oh, I'm holding over here. I've always been really fascinated by the movie Thunderheart. But, you know, that just gets in this little corner, put in this little cubby in my head. And then over here, I have my friend Mina Stays Light's story. And that's over here. And then, you know, sometimes it's through a matter of just sitting around and thinking and writing that I realize, oh, I might have something here. Let's see what happens if I try and put those things together.
And we talked about, you know, some essays that go into rape at the time and as a general issue. And you talk about some of those in the context of popular culture, which I found fascinating. There were movies that you mentioned, like Rocky with mm-hmm. Sylvester Stallone, Meatballs mm-hmm. with Bill Murray, TV shows like General Hospital, which all came out in the late 70s. And they all have storylines, which you write in the book, with the male protagonist forcing himself mm-hmm. on a woman. The woman resists and says no over and over, but is eventually broken down by the protagonist's persistence and, I guess, kind of charm that I don't quite see.
Right.
and falls in love. I'm a big fan of old movies, and unfortunately, that's an age-old trope, yeah. especially in so-called romantic comedies. There's even mm-hmm. a Christmas tune, Baby, It's Cold Outside, which is somewhat about date rape, but...
is a very controversial song.
Yes, a little bit more about date rape, but a lot of people just see it as holiday cheer.
Right.
Those movies, Rocky, Meatballs, General Hospital, and TV shows seem to have a big influence on the boys and girls at your school and at least one male teacher who you talk about mm-hmm. in terms of sexual abuse and grooming and mm-hmm. forcing mm-hmm. yourself, mm-hmm. A male forcing himself on a woman.
I have no idea what influenced that man. I can only guess. I have not spoken to him directly, but I have read many, 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 many interviews, articles in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the private reports that were done by schools like Choate and Kent Denver and Andover that talked at length about his actions. I don't know why he does what he does or did what he did. I don't even want to guess, to be perfectly honest, but I think the scary thing about it is how there was a period of time when people seemed to take for granted that adult male teachers had sexual relationships with students, underage students. And that's how they looked at it. They looked at it as relationships. They didn't look at it as abuse like we do now. And I think that was one thing for me that was really shocking is when I got emails, all of the alumni of my high school, Kent Denver, started getting emails, and I think it was 2017, saying that we've uncovered that this man who is part of a pattern of sexual abuse at East Coast boarding schools also ended up teaching here, and we're doing an investigation into it. So, of course, that was, wow, alarming. And so we all started talking to each other about it, and I didn't know this guy, just by whatever luck, I guess. But I was just amazed at people saying like, oh yeah, so-and-so was telling me they were sleeping with him or they were considering sleeping with him or blah, blah, blah. And these things were really out in the open. And I find that just alarming and shocking.
Yeah, I think one reason, in another essay, a reckoning, you write about rape and attempted rape, yeah, comparing your own experience in Denver with the aforementioned Brett Kavanaugh and mm-hmm. his hearings when he was accused of rape by his high school classmate, Christine Blasey Ford. You cite a 1985 survey from Ms. Magazine that just amazed me. Mm-hmm. They found that 1 in 4 college women were victims of rape or attempted rape as defined by law, technically, but only 25% of those women actually identified the incident as rape. And you say the main reason is because they knew the rapist. It was kind of cultural conditioning. It's not rape if I know the person. And I don't know if that's really gotten much better, but I wondered, was that just the futility of knowing no one in power would believe them? Or did they actually think, well, it's not rape, it's my mistake, you know, I got drunk, I must have flirted or something?
Oh, I think it's all of that, Ken. I definitely think that the latter that you were saying of, it's my fault, I got drunk, I was flirting, I'd already kissed him, I'd already done this, I'd already done that. The onus of that has always been put on women, not on men. You know, never has it been put on men. And so, you know, we're all carrying that with us. All women are carrying centuries of that with us, of not having agency over the word no. And so that's a huge part of it. And I also think, who's going to believe us? You know, in the few instances where people did tell someone or did confront, no one believed them. Nothing really came of it. And even in the instance that I discuss in that essay of something that had happened at my high school in, I think it was 2012, I want to say, long, long, long after I had graduated, a story of a young girl who had accused 3 boys of sexually assaulting her. You know, everyone got angry, people took sides, there were lawsuits. That had to be absolutely horrible for her. And, you know, I say in that essay, who would sign up for that? Well, Christine Blasey Ford did, and she got death threats.
Yeah, it's still happening. You can see it even in the the Johnny Depp Amber Heard.
That is horrifying.
Yes, where the whole jury sided yeah. with the abuser.
Yeah. And that is absolutely frightening, the extent to which that will continue to silence women.
Now, something not quite as serious as rape and discrimination and racism. No discussion of a generation would be complete without a look at their music. I say that
Yay!
As a baby boomer. And Gen X might be the last generation that actually had kind of something in common with music, because you were listening to the same sources, commercial yeah. radio, records, and cassettes. And now everything's the internet, yeah. starting with Napster and file sharing, and now Spotify and Pandora. And you mentioned several bands in the new book, Psychedelic Furs, The Cure, Talking Heads, Echo and the Bunnymen, The Cars, Depeche Mode, The Alarm, OMD, and Cabaret Voltaire. Mm. What was that relationship between Gen Xers and this music?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, because when I first started thinking about this book, I was talking to a friend of mine, running some ideas by him. And one of the things I said is, are we defined by the art that we consumed or the art that we created?
Ah.
Because what I was realizing is a lot of the music that was extremely important to us was not necessarily made by Gen X. It was people like older boomers younger boomers. That's what I meant to say. Younger boomers. I mean, you take somebody like Debbie Harry, you know, who's about to turn like 80, I think. I feel like I'm making that up, but I feel like I heard that recently and it was just shocking. I think we definitely caught on to this idea of things being done differently, of people breaking out of the mold, you know, and the new wave. We didn't even call it that. You know, we had new wave music, we had modern music, we had punk music back then. There was no such thing as the term alternative.
Power pop.
Yeah, things like that, right? We didn't have as many terms for alternative music as we do now, you know, post-punk and all that. But it was a different way to do things. And I think there was certain people who really grasped onto that, because, you know, it felt like there were only... Well, here we go again, but it felt like a lot of the music that was out there was very gendered and it was very straight, hetero, cis, all those things. And a lot of the new wave bands that came out there really broke that mold. And of course, David Bowie was a huge part of that. Lou Reed was a huge part of that. But they really, I think, opened up the doors for a lot of people to mess with the ideas of what we were and weren't allowed to do with music. And then through that, we really expanded because it wasn't just about music to us. It was about how we lived our lives. And I don't know if that's still true about music for kids today. You know, if it's as an encompassing experience.
I wonder the same way because, I'm baby boomer. So late 60s, early 70s, we all listened to the same music and it was revolutionary. And, you know, it really got you going. It was energetic. It was hopeful in a way. Of course, that Vietnam War era and protests. Mm-hmm. But it united a generation in a way. And I think the same thing with Gen X, but I don't know if that does that anymore. Yeah. Is there one person everybody listens to? I don't know, Lady Gaga? Or...
I was just going to say her. If there was, I think it would be her.
Right. But I can tell you, my wife will say, oh, you know her song. And I won't because I don't. No. Yeah, I don't listen to a commercial radio that plays her. Yeah. I certainly don't get it on the internet. And, you know, I would have to look it up. Nobody would curate that for me.
Yeah. And that's, I think, the amazing thing about it that's interesting is you and I, in our generations, we had to find things on our own, but we didn't find them by just going onto the internet. We walked into record stores and we flipped through records and we talked to our older siblings and our friends' older siblings. And, you know, maybe we were really psyched that we found that one radio station that was just barely coming in because it had a really low signal, but they were playing cool new stuff. And that's how we found new music. And then we'd take it home and we'd play it again and again and again and again with the headphones on and we'd read the lyrics on the liner notes. And, you know, so we were really immersed in it, even though we had to find it ourselves.
And yeah, of course, you know, kids can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And music is digital, so there's really no liner notes to read. Or I remember even watching the record kind of go round and round and round, you know, while I was kind of listening. I think my attention span was better, too. That maybe the internet has spoiled that for us all.
Good point.
It's a coherent whole, the book, and the essays are very connected by these themes that we've talked about. How'd you go about sequencing them? The book starts off, as I mentioned, with the Indian Way about your childhood friend, Mina, who later moved to Pine Ridge, and then ends with Falling Off Radar about another high school friend, Annie. And she was just missed, actually, being a victim of the Lockerbie bombing in 1988. Mm-hmm. She took a later flight than Pan Am Flight 103, but she lost several friends on that flight. How did you go about sequencing? It seems like those work just perfectly as start and end.
Well, so the very first essay in the book actually is Gen X Prep, which kind of focuses an introduction, right?
Yeah.
This is what I like to do. I actually like to have these short little essays at the beginning of my books that work like an introduction, but aren't called an introduction. Because I always feel like just start where it starts, you know, I start with some actual story. But yes, the first full length essay is The Indian Way. And one of the things I really wanted to do, especially because of Gen X Prep, is I wanted to make it clear, I'm not going to just be talking about white upper middle class people in this collection, that I'm investigating different ideas. And I also felt like a lot of what you've already talked about, which is using the pop culture in it, I want to set the stage for this is how I'm going to do this. I'm going to talk about real life people. I'm probably going to put some pop cultural context into it. I'm going to put some historical context into it as well. And I'm going to put a little bit of myself into it. And that changes how much of myself is in it throughout, you know, each essay, depending on the topic. So it also felt like a good way to introduce the reader to this is how this collection is going to work.
Oh, that's true. That works perfectly. And then the last story might be one of the most moving, or maybe because of its placement also. I'd like to talk just a little bit about that to end the conversation. That's, as I mentioned, called Falling Off Radar. Yeah. Again, about your high school friend, Annie, and how she had some survivor guilt. She had great loss. And the survivor's guilt that she wasn't on that ill-fated plane. We started talking out about a central theme in your work, about loss and recovering, and about people trying to connect back with themselves in the world again. And this story, this essay kind of gives us that.
Yeah. And I think it was one of the first stories outside of myself with which I became obsessed in that way around loss. And, you know, the bombing was in 1988. And I'll give everyone a little bit of context. Annie and I had been friends throughout high school. We'd kind of kept in touch in college. And then in winter of 1988, I was home for Christmas break and I was at Chili's with my dad in the bar waiting to get a table. And I saw Annie and her mom. And Annie was not Annie. She was not inside herself at that point, or she was so deep inside that you couldn't find her anymore. And I asked, hey, what's wrong? And it had just been a week since she'd lost all of her friends on that plane. And that haunted me for decades. That stuck with me forever and ever. It was this first look I had into a natural loss, you know, not just losing a grandparent. And I'd lost family members. I'd lost, by that time, two aunts of mine had died young. And this wasn't long actually before my mom died, but I didn't know she was going to die young either. But this was something different. This was the real challenge of how do you survive that? So I think maybe one of the reasons that it has, I think there's two reasons why it's, as you put it, particularly moving or poignant. And one of them is definitely because it's the one that had been with me the longest. And I think also because Annie was somebody very dear to me. It seems like a strange essay to end the book with because everything we're talking about here is obviously so horrible, but she's the epitome of hope somehow. You know, she doesn't push away the loss. She doesn't pretend it doesn't exist. And now she's at a point in her life where she's embracing it and telling that story. And there's something about that that was very hopeful for me.
And in her story, you learned something very valuable about yourself. You write, "I didn't know how loss changes us, how it twists into our DNA and alters our genetic code." That seemed to be very true for you at the time, even though mm-hmm. there were more losses to come. Mm-hmm. But at least at that point, you realized how deep it can go, how traumatic yeah. it could be.
Yeah. And I think that's an important thing for people to know if they've never experienced that kind of loss, even if they've experienced a not huge, enormous traumatic loss, but one that really touched them deeply. You to have someone taken away from you, and that impacts the way you are in this world. The world's different. It shifts. It tilts on its axis. But I think, you know, we have this idea that you get over a loss, or at least that you get over the most intense grieving part of it. And yes, that's true, hopefully, that you get to a point where at least you can go on and live your life and not be thinking about that. But it's in there. It is always in there. It's always inside of me. I remember a few years ago, a friend talking to me about how I'd changed since my family died. And I said to her, "I'm not the same person I used to be." And she said, "No, Liz, I know you are. I know you're in there somewhere." And I'm like, "No, I really am a different person. And I'm kind of okay with that." You know, this is what happened. I'm a different person. And that doesn't mean we can't be a happy person. It doesn't mean we're not capable of love or joy or all those things. And, you know, I have to be really straightforward about the fact that I did suffer from a very deep depression after all my family members died. And thank goodness I had a person who loved me, and I had a good therapist, and I had antidepressants that could pull me back to at least a place where I could, you know, try and understand what life could look like for me again after that point.
And I think in the story, you also write how Annie gives you that path toward recovery. Mm-hmm. In other words, a hope for optimism here, mm-hmm. rather than just dwelling in the loss. You have to accept the loss, mm-hmm. and not avoid it, and not try not to think of it, because that's all you'll think of. Mm-hmm. But it seemed that path toward recovery, towards reconnecting with the world. She tells you she's given up trying to understand why her friends were on that plane and not her. Was it some kind of cosmic fate? Are they kind of haunting her now? You write that she finally accepts what happened, why she was spared and her friends were murdered in a terrorist bombing. And she says, if you don't accept that in some way, in some fashion, how do you move forward? And that seemed to be a key for you too, where you were experiencing loss, but then you had, of course, all these ways of overcoming it, including your husband and the antidepressants and this new Liz, in mm-hmm. a way. But it seemed to me that, at least from reading the book, that seemed to be a turning point for you as well as Annie.
Yeah, I don't know if it was I think Annie she's a very optimistic person by nature. And I think I am too. I think that some people, I know a lot of people who are willing to live being depressed because they just think that's how life is. And I think I, for whatever reason, despite having very difficult circumstances surrounding my birth and what's happened with my family, I think I'm an optimist at heart, and I think I want to be happy. And so I'm going to pursue the way to be fulfilled, to be connected. And happy sounds like a really too easy word. And what I really mean is connected. I'm looking for a way to be connected. And I think Annie is the kind of person who's looking for a way to be connected to.
In light of what you just said, Liz, I wondered if you could read for us the last paragraph in that essay, Falling Off Radar, Liz. It's a beautiful last paragraph. And I hope it leaves listeners on a little bit more of an upbeat note, like it left me. I mean, it was very sad. It was beautiful. It was very moving. But I also found it kind of cause for hope.
Yeah. Okay. In 2019, Annie flew to Lockerbie, to the memorial built for her friends and the other victims. She talked with people who'd been there on the ground, who'd sorted through the crash debris, and she wrote. She is still writing. She is putting a voice to her loss. The story of the bombing and how she survived belongs to her, and the story of my family and how I survived belongs to me. And the place where those stories crisscross is the story of us all.
I just love that last line. And it was just so rewarding finishing the book and reading that paragraph and leaving on what I think is a hopeful note.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Liz, thanks so much for joining us today and for your wonderful new book.
Oh, and thank you so much for talking about it. You're just such a wonderful, thoughtful reader and interviewer, Ken.
Thank you, Liz. Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, or would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director, you can listen anytime, on demand, at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Liz Prado, author of the new essay collection, Kids in America, A Gen X Reckoning. Liz will be launching the new book in conversation with Lydia Yuknovich at Powell's City of Books on Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. She'll also be reading at Denver's Tattered Cover on Friday, June 24th, Annie Bloom's books on Tuesday, August 16th, and Broadway books on Thursday, September 29th. You can learn about all of Liz's events and her work online at lizprato.com. Just a reminder that KBOO is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. To support the station and programming like this, there's no better time to become a member yourself or renew your membership. Just go to kboo.fm and click on the big donate button. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, June 23rd at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
Carl Solomon, I'm with you in Rockland, where you're madder than I am.